Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Glad to be here.
Today, we are taking a stack of source material focused on mental health in, well, one of the most structurally stressed regions of the United States.
We're talking about the borderland of southern Arizona.
Exactly. We're focusing specifically on Mexican origin adults living in Pima, Yuma, and Santa Cruz counties.
And this is a deep dive into the findings of Morales and colleagues from 2023. Our mission is to really understand what's driving depressive symptoms in this priority population.
But not just what's driving them, right?
No, like, and this is critical. We also want to identify what protects them. We're looking at the interaction between these powerful buffers like hope and social support, and then the significant risks.
Things like physical pain and anxiety.
Exactly.
And the vulnerability is, it's just evident in the numbers right away. Before we even get to the predictors, what did the study establish about the baseline prevalence of depressive symptoms?
They found a worryingly high prevalence. A full 26.8% of participants met the criteria for depressive symptoms.
Wow, 26.8%. Can you put that in context for us?
Yeah, I mean, that figure sits high even within the typically elevated range for the teen adult population, which can run anywhere from, say, 16% to 40%.
Okay, so it's on the high end of an already high range.
Right. But then you compare that to non-Latin adults in the U.S., where the prevalence usually sits around 9%.
So it's almost triple. That is a staggering difference.
It really is. It shows this specific population navigating life near the border is experiencing a level of psychological stress that just demands attention.
And who are the people behind this number? What did the sample look like?
The sample was extremely focused, highly specific. We're looking at baseline data from 206 participants who are already considered at risk of chronic disease.
So they were already in the healthcare system in a way.
Yes, which is why they were engaging with community health workers through federally qualified health centers. And the demographics skew heavily.
Now so?
85.9% were female, and nearly half were middle-aged, between 45 and 64 years old.
So we are primarily discussing insights from middle-aged Mexican-origin women who are already dealing with compounding health challenges.
That's the core group, yes.
Okay, let's unpack the study and start where every health interventionist wants to start, with resilience. When they went hunting for these positive factors, things that act as a shield, what did the data scream about hope?
Hope was absolutely the knockout protective factor.
Mm.
I mean, it was crystal clear.
Okay.
The researchers found an extremely strong negative association with depressive symptoms.
Which is just a fancy way of saying.
It's a fancy way of saying that the higher the expression of hope, the significantly lower the levels of depressive symptoms. It wasn't just, you know, a little bit protective. It was one of the most powerful influences in the entire model.
And it sounds like this isn't just passive optimism. How did they actually define and measure something as crucial as hope here?
That's a great point. They use the State Hope Scale, which is designed to measure current actionable hope. They aren't asking, are you generally optimistic?
It's more specific.
Much more. They're focusing on two components. First, agency.
Agency.
Which is your perceived ability and motivation to reach your goals. And second, pathways.
Pathways.
Meaning your belief that you can think of concrete ways to achieve those goals even when you're faced with roadblocks. The questions reflect that.
Can you give an example?
Sure. They ask things like, I am energetically pursuing my goals, or I can think of many ways to get out of a jam. It's about that directional thinking.
So it's about feeling empowered and having a mental roadmap, regardless of the terrain. Mm. I find it fascinating that the source material connects the lack of this hope to the concrete, unavoidable realities faced by this community.
Precisely. Prior research among Mexican origin women confirms this. Hopelessness isn't just an internal state. It is often directly triggered by external, concrete life crises.
Like what?
We're talking about partner issues like incarceration or substance use, family illnesses, or the inability to meet basic material needs.
Things like securing reliable transportation or housing.
Exactly. Hope in this context, it acts as an essential mental shield. It allows individuals to maintain that sense of agency when structural hardship is trying to crush their pathways.
That is a massive finding for intervention strategy.
Yeah.
Definitely shows where resources might have the greatest impact. But what happens when that external pressure is relentless? Let's pivot to the negative factors they hypothesized would increase vulnerability.
Physical pain and anxiety symptoms.
Right. What did you see there?
We saw very clear effects, especially with physical pain. The second key finding is that the severity of physical problems was positively and significantly related to depressive symptoms.
So more pain, more depression.
In a nutshell, yes. If participants reported more severe physical health issues, more pain, more functional limitations, they were much more likely to report higher levels of depression.
Wait, if physical pain is such a strong predictor, why didn't the traditional demographic factors like age, sex, or education level matter more in the final models? Isn't that a bit counterintuitive?
That's a great question, and it speaks to the power of this specific structural context and cultural expression.
Go on.
When we control for these internal factors like hope and these external manifestations like physical pain, those things just become the major drivers. The demographic markers like age or education, they become less relevant because in this region, the structural stressors, poverty, lack of insurance, they hit across all demographics. But the physical experience of pain and the ability to maintain hope, that's what truly defines the individual mental health outcomes here.
That makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about that physical pain measurement. What exactly were they quantifying?
They used four items from a standardized health survey, the SF-8. It focused not just on pain levels, but on functional limitation.
So how it impacts your daily life.
Exactly. How much did physical health limit daily activities? How much difficulty did they have with work at home or outside the home? And how much bodily pain did they experience over the last 4 weeks? It's really a measure of how much physical suffering intrudes on everyday life.
And this finding is so critical because of how mental health is often expressed in Mexican culture.
Absolutely. It reinforces this vital public health concept that individuals of Mexican origin may often express their psychological distress, their depressive symptoms, through what we call somatic complaints.
They focus on physical ailments.
Right. Headaches, stomach problems, generalized bodily pain, rather than voicing traditional psychological symptoms like persistent sadness or, you know, anhedonia.
So if healthcare systems aren't trained to recognize that sort of body language of distress,
they miss the depression entirely. This is why addressing physical pain isn't just treating a physical problem. It's often the most reliable entry point for identifying mental distress in this community.
That shifts the entire clinical focus. You have to look beyond a psychological checklist.
Yeah.
So we've established two clear main effects. Hope is a powerful shield and pain is a major predictor. But the study went deeper.
It did. It examined how these factors interact, specifically bringing anxiety into the picture.
And this is where it gets more nuanced.
This is where we hit the nuance. The researchers found what's called a moderating effect involving anxiety symptoms. We know anxiety itself is related to depression, but they wanted to see if it changed the relationship between hope and depression.
Walk us through that. What did the study ultimately show?
Okay, think of hope as a heavy, protective winter coat, keeping you safe from the cold of depression.
Got it.
The study showed that hope is incredibly effective. However, when anxiety shows up, that nagging worry, that constant stress, it's like that coat suddenly gets a small, persistent tear.
So it weakens the protection.
It doesn't eliminate it, but it measurably reduced its positive protective effectiveness against depressive symptoms. Hope is still strong, but it has to work a lot harder to do its job when anxiety is present.
That analogy makes the concept much clearer. So if we can dial down the anxiety, the protective strength of hope springs back to full power. But wait, If they found this moderating effect, we have to talk about how anxiety was actually measured because the source material brings up a pretty significant caveat here.
You are right to be skeptical. While the finding is compelling, the researchers themselves stressed caution. This interaction effect was only marginally significant, statistically.
And more importantly.
More importantly, they measured anxiety symptoms using only a single item. A simple yes-no question asking, do you have the following health problem? Anxiety.
A single yes-no question. That means they couldn't distinguish between someone with, say, mild nervousness and someone with a severe anxiety disorder.
Exactly. This lack of detail means the study could not distinguish between different gradients or types of anxiety symptoms. This is a classic example of a finding that's highly suggestive.
It shows us where to look next.
Exactly. But it's one we need to interpret carefully until future studies use, you know, multidimensional scales to really define this relationship.
It definitely leaves a fascinating cliffhanger for future researchers. Okay, moving on to another key area. The factors that were surprisingly not significant in this population, the big one that jumped out at me was social support.
Right.
Why did that drop out of the model?
This was perhaps the most counterintuitive finding. I mean, we often assume that general social support is this universal antidote to loneliness and depression.
But not here.
But this study found no significant association between generalized social support and depressive symptoms once they controlled for those stronger factors like hope and pain.
So why might having a generalized network not be enough in this highly stressed environment?
Well, the researchers propose that future research needs to be far more nuanced. They're saying we need to break down social support.
Stop lumping it all together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Instead, look at the difference between, say, emotional comfort, just having someone to talk to, versus instrumental support, like getting physical help with groceries or a ride to a medical appointment.
And more importantly, they suggest looking at the dark side of social ties.
Yes. They suggest the key factor might not be the presence of positive support, but the absence of negative interactions.
Things like criticism, rejection.
Frequent family criticism, rejection, or deceit. Those may be far more salient predictors of depression than just having some general support. If the family structure itself is a source of intense stress, adding a friend or two won't necessarily move the needle on depression.
So quantity isn't quality, and negative quality might just negate all the positive quantity. That's a critical insight. What else fell out of the model?
As we touched on earlier, all the major sociodemographic factors, age, sex, education level, immigration status, you know, whether someone was born in the U.S. or Mexico.
None of them were significant predictor.
Not once hope and pain were accounted for. The psychological and physical components were just driving the outcomes far more than the standard demographic profile.
Which brings us right back to the structural context of the border region itself, because this whole study is framed by the constraints of southern Arizona.
That framing is essential. We can't divorce the mental health outcomes from the structural vulnerability of this region. The U.S.-Mexico border area is defined by severe structural issues.
Yeah.
We see persistently high rates of poverty, undereducation, unemployment, and critically, a lack of health insurance coverage and a scarcity of healthcare professionals.
These are constant background stressors.
Exactly. They aggravate mental health vulnerabilities and make conditions like anxiety and depression just that much harder to treat.
So considering all this, the high prevalence, the strength of hope, the weight of somatic complaints, what does this mean for intervention? The study was implemented through federally qualified health centers using community health workers, or CHWs.
Yes.
What unique role do these individuals play, given what the study found?
They are absolutely indispensable. They provide the perfect, culturally sensitive delivery mechanism for these findings.
How so?
The source material notes that Mexican-origin adults often prefer to rely on self-care, counseling, and social support from within their community over medication or specialist mental health therapy.
And CHWs operate right at that nexus.
At that exact nexus. They're the trusted community members who can recognize that a constant headache or chronic stomach pain might be a sign of depression.
They can bridge that gap between the physical complaint and the psychological need.
Precisely. They can maximize hope by helping individuals see viable pathways out of those concrete structural jams, helping them navigate complex social service systems, address physical pain, and restore that sense of agency. The CHW model is just designed to be effective, accessible, and culturally resonant.
This has truly been a deep dive into resilience and risk in a high-need community. Let's bring together the core takeaways for you, the learner.
I think the main lessons are threefold. First, the prevalence of depressive symptoms is severely elevated in this border region sample, sitting at that 26.8% figure.
Right.
Second, hope is an incredibly powerful, significant protective factor, and it's tied directly to a feeling of agency and direction.
And third?
Third, physical pain severity is a strong and positive predictor of depressive symptoms, which just underscores the necessity of treating these somatic complaints as a potential window into psychological distress.
So if we step back, what is the public health mandate here?
Achieving health equity requires, I think, a two-pronged strategy. You have to target physical pain, which is a crucial entry point for treatment, and you have to actively promote that sense of agency and hope among Mexican-origin adults.
And there's another benefit.
Yes, the very act of collecting and diffusing this knowledge helps reduce the stigma associated with accessing mental health care. It increases the likelihood of engaging with services delivered by crucial personnel like CHWs.
That brings us to our final thought for you to mull over. We learned that the presence of anxiety symptoms, even when measured minimally, seem to marginally weaken the strong protective effect of hope. If hope gives us direction, and anxiety is fundamentally about internal worry and avoidance, this suggests a critical intervention point.
It really does.
So consider this. How might addressing anxiety, even at sub-threshold levels, be the key to unlocking the full protective potential of hope for individuals facing multiple relentless structural hardships?